Welcome to the second episode of Rob's Tech Tape. We finally have a name for this, which I'll explain in a little bit. But you've left 13 questions on social media and on YouTube, so let's get this thing moving. All right, first things first, Rob's Tech Tape. If you've watched our podcasts or listened to them on iTunes, you know that there are quite a few funny jokes entitled Rob's Sex Tape. Here's one that I found on the internet. It's hairy, but not hard. Title of Rob's Sex Tape. But all right, obviously the title of this segment is a play on words for that one. So let's get moving into it. First things first, I've got a correction from the first episode of Rob's Tech Tape. And 29+5 on YouTube corrected me in that I said that Moto 2 is moving to a 675 Triumph motor next year. That's absolutely wrong. They're moving to a 765 Triumph engine. It's pretty similar to the 675 motor. It's bored out a little bit. They're doing some testing with it. I honestly knew that. I just spoke way too fast, and I got to slow down just a little bit. But all right, moving on to question number one. All right, first up is Alexander from Instagram. How come the engine architecture in MotoGP happens to be typically a V4 instead of an inline 4 like Suzuki uses? All right, so first thing here, Yamaha also uses an inline 4, so we can't discount them. Everyone else is on a V4. Suzuki did actually race a V4 in their last MotoGP bike before they left the series for a little bit. Kawasaki was on an inline 4 for a while as well. To be honest, there are disadvantages and advantages to both engine configurations. I don't think that there are really any, like, I don't think that one engine configuration is dramatically better than the other one. Each one has different packaging, right? The I4s, the inline 4s are a little bit wider, but they're shorter. The V4 is more narrow, but they have a harder time getting a large airbox in there. They have different weight distributions. They end up with different power pulses. But as we've seen with even superbikes and especially with the Yamaha M1, right, the power pulses of the motor, they can make a big bang motor out of a V4, they can make a big bang motor out of an I4, so it really doesn't all that much. And to be honest, I already brought up Suzuki running a V4 back in the day. They were running that V4 in MotoGP when their Gixxer 1000 was doing great in superbike racing, at least in national racing especially. So I wouldn't say that the factories need to develop only one. They can do both and still race well. All right, moving on to question number two. Burke from Instagram as well wants to know if I figured out why my R6 chucks me to the sky when I was going slowly. So if you haven't seen our social media, I crashed at Buttonwillow Raceway doing some practice laps almost 2 weeks ago now on Friday. Essentially what happened was one of my lower radiator hoses came off and it sprayed the header with the water and it steamed up my rear tire. Turns out there was actually no water left on track, which I thought was really surprising. There was only a tiny bit of water in the belly pan, which is why I didn't find this out, but it was pretty obvious when that hose wasn't on there. The hose clamp was tight-ish, but it wasn't tight enough and it wasn't safety wired. So I feel really bad about it, but hopefully I've remedied that situation. All right, moving on to number three. So this is another two-parter, 3 and 3A. 29+5 on YouTube wants to know about the carbon fiber swing arms, and Burke, the same user from before, wants to know about carbon tube suspension components. So here, we'll start off with swing arms first. Obviously, HRC and MotoGP just came out with their carbon fiber swing arm. Mark Marquez and Danny Pedrosa haven't raced it yet, but they have tested with it extensively. They thought about racing it in Qatar, but didn't. Supposedly the teams don't have enough spares yet for them to run it for the entire weekend, which is why they haven't yet. As far as disadvantages, what disadvantages? Right? Carbon fiber is more tunable than aluminum, right? You can lay up the carbon fiber in many different orientations. You can use a unidirectional carbon fiber. You can use a standard weave. You can make it thicker. You can make it thinner. The thing can be as light as you want. It can flex as much as you want. It can have rotational torsion as much as you want. It does anything. But that's the problem, right? The problem is that MotoGP teams don't have a shit ton of experience using composites for components like a swing arm. Because of that, what's the best they can do? Maybe their first swing arm that they made was exactly like their aluminum swing arm, and then they tested it, and then they make subtle changes. So honestly, I don't think that there are any huge disadvantages right now, as long as you can find out what's going on. There also aren't any huge advantages. Like, you can make a carbon fiber swing arm lighter than an aluminum one, most likely, but it may not be happening now. As far as forks, we saw Ohlins produce carbon fiber forks last year in MotoGP, and I'm pretty sure every single factory ran. Suzuki didn't run them. Yamaha, Ducati, and HRC definitely ran them. Pretty much all of the racers raced on them eventually. The known advantage that we've heard from the factory teams is that they are lighter, so it allows them to move the weight balance around of the motorcycle, right? If the forks are lighter, higher up, you have to add more ballast. You can put the ballast wherever you want to. It moves the weight around on the bike. Ohlins is doing this development, so it is taking a little bit of weight off the shoulders of the factory teams. But at the same time, right, we don't know what Ohlins is doing with that. There may be an advantage in tuning the stiffness of the forks because, again, it is a composite, and these bikes depend very heavily on stiffness of all the chassis components for grip at max lean angle, but we don't really know. All right, moving on. Question number four. Alexi from YouTube wants to know, how do wildcards work in MotoGP? If he does a few track days a year, can he compete at COTA? So this is a really interesting one because, you know, I mean, I might be a little bit faster than Alexi right here, but it would be very interesting to try and go out for a MotoGP wildcard. Unfortunately, no way in hell it's going to happen. So the way that it works, at least what I can gather from the regulations, is that every FMN, so Federation Motorcyclists in Nationale, right? So a national series can issue Grand Prix licenses. However, after those licenses are issued, both IRTA and the GPC, the Grand Prix Commission, must approve those rides. So it's not like, even if you could get Moto America to approve you a Grand Prix license, which probably won't happen unless you already own or have a national license with them, the GPC is not just going to approve anyone. These licenses are definitely really hard to get. Wildcards are, that's for a full season. Wildcards are a little bit easier to get because they issue one event Grand Prix licenses, but again, it's still the FMN issuing that license and still the GPC approving it. As far as how wildcards work in GP, in GP, there's a maximum of 2 wildcards per race. So that's for the entire grid, right? They don't want, you know, 30 racers showing up for a grid because it kind of detracts from the 24 spots that they have there. Every team that does not have concessions, so like factory, Ducati, Yamaha, and Honda, they only get three wild cards per year. Every team with concessions, so Suzuki, KTM, and Aprilia, they get 6 wild cards per year. Like, we already saw KTM has applied for a shit ton for Mika Kallio, and they'll be using all of them. There is also a rule that a team cannot run a wild card at back-to-back rounds, right? They're really trying to take away the importance of wild cards and make sure that the 24 riders that are on the grid get the best exposure because they've signed up for that. A few other things, like in Moto 2, it's actually 13,000 euros to run a wild card. Like, that pays for the insurance and the medical and pretty everything that needs to happen at a Moto 2 round should something go wrong. For Moto 3, it's only 3,500 euros, which is way cheaper, and I'm not sure why. And then the cost during GP was unlisted, so I'm not entirely sure on that. But yeah, safe to say, for someone racing track days, or even for me, like a national rider that's never won a national race, never going to get a wild card in MotoGP. All right, moving on. Question number 5. B Chiller from Instagram wants to know, how the fuck do the pros dangle their leg while braking and manage downshifts before tipping in? All right, this one's actually pretty simple. They do the dangle after accomplishing all of the shifting. So the slipper clutches, the engine braking controls, and the seamless gearboxes are so amazing in GP that they can pop all of those downshifts. Say they're going from sixth all the way down to fourth gear. They can do it right away, get it done, even when they're still doing 150 miles an hour, and make it into a 60-mile-an-hour corner. This is actually kind of the way that riding is moving for most racers. A lot of the national racers and club racers that are fast, the ones that I've talked to, I know that they do their shifting this way. One actually that trains people suggested that, or he told me that his riding improved dramatically when he started doing all the shifting like that, suggested that it's a much better idea for corner entry. That way you can focus on the turning, You don't really have to worry about the downshifts. Of course, though, this only works if you have your slipper clutch and your engine braking control tuned perfectly to do that. If you try and do this on a bike without a slipper clutch or one that has like the stock springs in an R6, it's not going to go well. So don't try it. All right. Get the racer set up. If you want to do this, practice it at the track. All right. Moving on to number 6. All right. Sir Jane wants to know, I thought Yamaha's winglets were illegal. How did they pass? They seem the same. So if you haven't watched the Qatar race, the Yamaha winglets resemble the mustache winglets that they had last year. The main difference this year is that now the winglet, it goes out like the mustache winglet, but then it curves back in and attaches at a second spot. And that's the main way that they're now legal, is they have two attachment points and they're firmly like a smooth duct around the entire around the fairing, right? So there is no sharp edges, there's nothing kind of jutting out and just like a corner on the top, the edge there. And to be honest, Danny Aldred, the MotoGP technical director, he can approve whatever the hell he wants. As long as he feels that it's safe and as long as it passes the simple rules that they have, that are no sharp edges, nothing sticking off the fairing, it's totally fine. So we'll probably see something similar like that the entire year. Obviously now the teams have homologated their first set of winglets, so they get one change later on in the year, and I don't think they're going to change all that much. All right, moving on to question number 7. Acid Rain Trip on Instagram wants to know, you may have talked about this before, but wondering how much engine braking is used in MotoGP, and how much do I personally use on the track with my R6? So engine braking is it, and we'll get into this more in a little bit in the next question, but engine braking is one of the most important things for a motorcycle going fast around the racetrack. I would guess that in MotoGP, they use significantly less than any street bike you've ever ridden. I mean, even on my bike, my slipper clutch has 3 springs that come stock from the factory. The hot setup for those springs is to cut 2 of them off entirely. So you take the spring is shaped like it's kind of shaped like a Y, and you cut all 3 of the fingers off, and then you put the spring back in to act like a washer. You take 2 springs, cut them off. So you may be reducing the engine braking by 60%. I still kind of want less engine braking out of the slipper clutch. So because of that, I use the engine braking control in my flash, and I leave the throttle bodies open while I've actually closed the throttle tube. So my throttle bodies stay open 1 to 2% on corner entry. That's kind of how you hear the engine still sound like it's revving up a little bit as racers go into the corner, because the throttle bodies aren't fully closed. This really helps you get through the corner. I mean, engine braking is the most important parameter for me, because all your speed around the racetrack starts at corner entry. If you don't get into the corner fast, you don't brake well, you can't turn as well as you need to, and you can't get out of the corner fast. So engine braking, super, super important. I mean, with MotoGP, they tune it on a turn-by-turn basis, so that's one of the most important settings for them. And actually, that question leads into the next one. So question number 8, Sinister Planet on Instagram wants to know, what's actually happening when the MotoGP teams are working on their electronic settings? He understands they're looking for drive and grip, but what are the settings or parameters that they're adjusting the most? Is it custom engine or suspension maps? Actually, it's not. Just like the question before, I would say the number one thing that they're adjusting is engine braking. The second thing that they're mostly adjusting is what's called slip target. So engine braking, right, you're adjusting how much the throttle bodies stay open on a turn-by-turn basis. The slip target actually is how much faster is the rear tire turning than the speed of the motorcycle. So we have wheel speed sensors on the rear wheel. We have wheel speed sensors on the front wheel. We have the IMU doing calculations based on the lean angle. And all that information is used to calculate what's called a slip percentage. Most of the time, they shoot for a slip percentage around 10%. So the rear wheel, and this is only on corner exit, the rear wheel is moving about 10% faster than the actual motorcycle. That actually gives optimal drive. If you go down to like 2% slip or 0% slip, you won't be going as fast out of the corner as you would if you were using 10% slip. If you go up to 15% slip, you might actually end up with a slower drive. So you would wonder, like, but I said around 10%. A rider may want 8% out of a corner because they don't want all that oversteer. they may want 12 to 15% out of a corner because they want more oversteer to be able to finish the turn. Maybe you want less slip target to help save the tire, but you want a little bit more to make sure that you finish the corner. It's all, there's such a fine line there between not going as fast as you possibly could and setting your best lap time. So I think those two parameters, engine braking and slip target, are the thing that they change the most. Obviously, there are other things too, like the throttle map, the fuel maps, the ignition maps. But I honestly suspect that most of those parameters are set at the factory, at the dyno. They're more engine parameters that they don't change all that much. They might change the fuel a little bit in between sessions because they have oxygen sensors on each of the cylinders so they can see if the fuel map is wrong. And the fuel map can also change, the fuel map and the throttle map can change like how smooth the bike is when they start to turn the throttle and when they get out of the corner. They might need to make small changes there, but I wouldn't say that's the bulk of their work. For the last part of that question, suspension maps. There are no suspension maps. So electronic suspension is banned in MotoGP. So there's no such thing as a real suspension map. And I think it's very unlikely that the suspension potentiometers are used to input data into the ECU and then affect the tune. They have the IMU to figure out the chassis attitude or to figure out how much lean angle the motorcycle has. So they don't really need it there. All right, moving on. Question number 9. We got 4 or 5 left. Here we go. So Nitro wants to know, and actually this is 9 and 9A. Nitro and Panigale John want to know about Marco Melandri's wobble at the last two World Superbike rounds. So especially in Thailand, you'd seen he'd be on the straightaway. They'd be getting close to top speed, and the bike's just doing a little huckabuck down the straightaway. I actually wouldn't call that wobble. I'd call that weave. So wobble is a term that mostly defines head shake. You're going down the straightaway and the bars just start doing this. It's actually a pretty simple, wobble is a very fast oscillation. The handlebars are moving pretty quickly. It's something that's relatively easy to fix. You change like a trail measurement, you change the front ride height of the chassis and it'll probably go away. Weave is considerably different. It's a slow oscillation. It comes out of the rear of the motorcycle and it's a big pain in the ass because a lot of like, It's not something where you can just change one thing and it's definitely going to be fixed. It's almost like chatter where the factories may not know exactly why it's happening and don't know how to fix it. But to be honest, I think Ducati knows how to fix the weave. The only problem is I bet you their fix that they have for Marco Melandri would actually make Melandri slower, which is why they haven't fixed it. I mean, obviously, Melandri is a tiny rider. Him on his motorcycle, on his Ducati, presents a significantly different weight bias compared to Chaz Davis. They probably run a dramatically different setup. But we can see in the four races that have already happened that Marco Melandri is doing, he's much better on the brakes. He's a much more confident rider. His corner speed is higher. He doesn't look like the unconfident Marco Melandri that was racing in World Superbike last year. So I kind of think that the fixes they did to get Marco Melandri comfortable have produced this weave slightly. They'll probably, if I'm not mistaken, they tested at Jerez a week ago, so they were probably working on that, even though Jerez doesn't exactly have a very long straightaway. I suspect that Ducati will fix it probably before mid-season. And either way, Marco Melandri is still winning races, so it shouldn't affect, it doesn't seem to be affecting him too much. All right, that was all for 9. Number 10. So, what? Calgan Hamjo from Instagram. What are the main differences between my R6 and a Calex frame, and what do they do differently? So, the Calex is a Moto2 chassis. It's the most prolific chassis in Moto2. If I had to buy a Moto2 bike right now, which I really, really want to do, I would buy a Calex. They're getting cheaper, which is nice because they're going to be even cheaper still next year because the class is moving to Triumph engines. But all right, so what's an interesting Calex and the Yamaha chassis that I have? So the number one thing is the amount of effort that Calex put into making that chassis. Calex tried really, really, really hard to make that bike go faster on a racetrack. Yamaha did not do that for the R6. They tried to make something cost-effective as a street bike that they could sell for not too much money. I mean, you can see with the Yamaha chassis, it hasn't changed since 2008, Right. In 2006 and 2007, the chassis had a little frame spar that they that kind of was around the airbox and around the air filter. The 2008 and even the 2017 chassis, the frame spar is just cut off. Like, and it's not a nice cut. It's not like they took an angle grinder to or a cutoff wheel to it. It looks like they took a torch to it and just cut it off, because I've seen multiple chassis side by side and they look different, which means the cut was not made nicely. Yamaha has not done work on this chassis, even with the new bike. It works. It wins races. It sells motorcycles. Why the hell are they going to change it? That's the main thing. So, I mean, Kalex is doing things like optimizing chassis stiffness. They optimize it for hard braking. They optimize it for high lean angle grip. Yamaha has not done that. Kalex, obviously they've got multiple rear linkages that they optimize for track use. Yamaha put a linkage on there that works good for street use and you can carry a passenger on. Kalex make sure that their bike has a triple clamp that affords great stability at high speeds. Yamaha works with parking lot speeds at 5 miles an hour up to the track day riders, right? It's great that my R6 goes amazingly fast around a racetrack without any chassis changes, but you see other super sport and other super bikes that are street bikes that they don't work for shit in stock form, and then you have to modify them a little bit, right? There are certain bikes that you need to put triple clamps on. There are certain bikes that you have to put a new linkage on. Some things just don't work because the factory didn't put effort into it to make it a race bike. The other main difference between a Moto 2 bike and a super sport bike is the size. I've heard that the seat is like 2 inches lower on a Moto 2 bike. The whole bike is narrower. The frontal area is smaller. That's how Moto 2 bikes are so fast at racetracks like Coda and other tracks with long straightaways. Even though they have like 120 horsepower super sport motors, they go just as fast as national super bikes. Not in trap speeds, but in lap times, because of all these optimizations and because they're tiny. All right, moving on to question number 11. All right, so Grumpy Rider wants to know, what are the rods that run parallel to fork tubes in World Superbike and MotoGP? Are they just to measure fork movement? Are they used to collect telemetry? And do they offer real-time input into the ECU to or make other adjustments during the race? So those sensors are called linear potentiometers. So they're just linear position sensors for the suspension. So you guessed correctly on that one. There is actually one on the shock back underneath. It's only about the length of the shock as well. Those sensors in MotoGP should only be for data logging. And they're used for chassis setup during and after the session. I'm pretty certain that in MotoGP, the teams are not allowed to pipe that data into the spec ECU, into the Magneti Marelli ECU. I couldn't find the wording in the GP regulations, but I'm fairly certain on that. In World Superbike, things are a little bit different because we don't have spec ECUs. Teams probably could be cheating if they felt like it, but I suspect that, again, it's the same deal. They're only piping that into the data logger, and they're not allowed to put that in the information into the ECU, nor into the IMU. All right, moving on. Question number 12. We got two left. All right, number 12. Why do, in MotoGP, why when they pull away from the pits, they always click down for neutral? And then wouldn't that be starting in second gear? Also, and then, so that's the first part here. So Troy, gearboxes in MotoGP are neutral, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. So neutral is at the bottom. It's not between first and second gear. So with GP shift, they click down for first, they click down for second, they click down for third, all the way up to sixth gear. In order for them to get to neutral, they likely have a lever or a button on the handlebars, and that's the neutral lockout switch. And they hold that, and then they're allowed to go back into neutral. Obviously, if they didn't have that lever, then when they're downshifting into a first gear corner, if they accidentally popped an extra one, they'd end up in neutral. They'd probably crash. They'd probably run off. Maybe someone would run into the back of them. It'd be terrible. I thought I saw a rumor that the Moto 3 KTM bike was this same gear pattern, but I couldn't confirm that, and I don't think they are. I know the Honda's not, the NSF 250R, and I know the Mahindra wasn't. Who knows about the Suter that existed for a little while, and the KTM can't confirm, but no one says that, so it's probably not. Second part of the question, if the software is only calibrating based on time, so we're talking about the spec ECU and how the spec ECU and actually both World Superbike and in MotoGP, the software in the spec ECU knows the position of the motorcycle on track. So he's saying if they're only calibrating based on time and not on GPS, if you blow a turn and keep riding, doesn't the engine braking and everything else, isn't it going to be off until you get back to the start finish straight? So that's the thing there. On the start finish straight, we hit a timing sector and the bike knows where it is. There are four timing sectors around the track. So there are three other spots besides start finish where the bike can reset itself or it can recalibrate its position. I also wouldn't be surprised if the motorcycle could recalibrate itself based on every straightaway. So they do a turn, they miss it, but you know, you blow a right turn, you're still turning right a little bit. So it knows that you turned right. You still kind of end up on the straightaway. So it it recognizes that you're going straight again and it recalibrates itself. There were years ago, like I'm talking, you know, 2012 or whatever, we would occasionally see that a rider's bike would get confused. I remember one year, Nicky Hayden, his motorcycle got the sectors flipped. So it thought that the start of sector three was actually the start finish and vice versa. So all his engine braking controls were wrong. And it was shitty for him. But then, you know, that was back before Spec ECU. But to be honest, like, the factories have had input into the Spec ECU. The software has come a long way even since then. I don't think the bikes are ever getting lost anymore. All right, number 13, last question here. How does the draft work for motorcycles from Ohm 3D? Wouldn't there be buffeting at 350 kilometers an hour? All right, so drafting is pretty... It's pretty much the same for any moving vehicle, right? The drafting works as normal. The bike ahead creates what's called essentially a low pressure area behind it. So it a lot of people would say that it pushes the air out of the way. Because it pushes the air out of the way, the air can't recombine behind the motorcycle very easy. Because it can't recombine behind the motorcycle, there's a gap. There's a small amount of vacuum. It's a low pressure area behind the motorcycle. If you're riding in that area, your motorcycle now has less drag on it because there's less air moving across it. So that's how drafting works. It works on cars that way, it works on planes that way, it works on bicycles that way. It's all the same. Actually, being in the draft actually removes a tiny bit of drag from the front motorcycle as well because it takes up some of that low pressure space. The low pressure space actually creates drag on the motorcycle as well because you can imagine that vacuum pulls on things. So if you have vacuum behind something, it's going to be pulling it backwards. That also creates drag. It's called pressure drag. But as far as buffeting goes, it really depends. There should be no buffeting right behind the motorcycle, or at least very minimal buffeting. But that's right when you're on their ass. If you pulled back a little bit or you pulled slightly to the side, you're going to be getting into that boundary of turbulent air. The turbulent air itself, it kind of, the amount of it really all depends on the motorcycle. It depends on the rider, depends on the speed that they're moving. We could imagine that winglets, because they're adding or they're taking energy or adding energy to the air, they are actually going to stir the air up more. They're going to make it more turbulent. This could cause more buffeting. But at the same time, now that we have ducted winglets, the ducts on the side could be keeping the air on the side of the motorcycle more laminar and less turbulent and actually reducing buffeting, right? We haven't heard that much about the buffeting after the real winglets went away. So I'm not too sure on that. I mean, in my experience, I've drafted people at Road America and at Utah Motorsports Park, or formerly known as Miller, and I've hit, you know, 157, 160 miles an hour in the draft, and I don't experience a problem with it. You're behind the guy, you pull out, and you try and pass him on the brakes. There's really no buffeting there. Your helmet moves around a little bit, but it's not like the motorcycle's moving around. But to be fair, at 350 kilometers per hour, about 217 miles an hour, the wind energy is probably at least twice as strong. There's no way it's linear. It's got to be at least a square relationship. So it's probably twice, if not more, if not stronger than that. So they still could be experiencing buffeting. They're pro racers. They deal with it. We saw amazing speeds at Qatar. We saw passes into the first corner. We didn't see any problems with drafting. I mean, if they bitch about it again, we're just going to roll our eyes a little bit. But all right, that's all my questions. It's Wednesday right now before the Argentina round for MotoGP. We will definitely have a video after that. Please like, share, and subscribe on this. And please leave me comments in the YouTube video or questions in the comments of the YouTube video for things that you want me to answer later. I will do more of these videos. I promise I'm not going to, I'll do them more often than monthly. I just got to know that the questions are there. You left a ton on Instagram. I'm sorry if I didn't get to your questions. There were a couple that I had no clue on, so we didn't go over those. But yeah, thanks for listening to Rob's Tech Tape. Follow BrotoGP, like, share, and just subscribe to this video, and check out our podcast as well. Peace.